Well, hello. How is everybody? And welcome back to For What It's Worth podcast. This is some episode that I cannot remember the number of. I'm going to have to look it up as we get further into the belly of the beast. And wow, so it's been a few weeks since I have done a For What It's Worth podcast. And just for those of you who are new to the podcast, just know that absolutely no one asked me to do this. And in fact, I really have no idea how many people listen to this podcast, but my guess is not very many. I should not be making this podcast right now. I should be doing 14 other things that I have the responsibility and I'm on the hook to produce as of now. But for some reason, it just felt like the time. And typically what happens when it comes to doing one of these is I'm in the middle of tasks and I just decide to do it. That's it. There is no planning. There's no schedule. There's no document. There's no nothing. It's just me saying, hey, I'm going to stop what I'm doing right now and I'm going to do a podcast. And that's it. There's no, again, no schedule. I don't know why I'm doing this one right now, and I have no idea when the next one is going to be. It could be a week, it could be a month, it could be a day. I don't really know. It doesn't matter. But for those of you who are here, and those of you who are new, we typically have a little bit of a, I don't know, formula, if you will, a template. We start out with who this podcast is for, and then we talk about the hero of the week, the goat of the week, and then we get to some interesting topics. And these topics are all over the place. Now, a lot of people come to me because of my background in photography, and they want to talk about photography. We've got the geeks who want to get into the minutia of fluoride elements. And then we get the people who want to talk about images. There's at least two of those out there. Two of you. Two of you out there are like, let's talk about images, man. Let's edit and break these things down. And the two of you are grossly outnumbered by the geeks who just want to talk about equipment. But that's the price you pay for being around the modern photography world. And maybe there's one or two of you out there who want to talk about photo books, and all that's good. I like to talk about photography. I like to talk about photo books. And the sad curse is that I like to talk about a lot of other things. Now remember, I'm one guy with one opinion. I went to public school in America, which is not the top echelon of education worldwide. Our numbers are way, way down. We're like mid-pack. We excel in things like infant mortality, and we suffer with things like education. That's just what it means to be in America these days. Even though that's supposedly un-American to say that, I call it the truth. But hey, let's talk about that in a minute. Post-truth culture. We are now fully embedded in post-truth culture, which is a very, very difficult riddle to solve if you're someone who doesn't want to live in post-truth culture. And some of us don't. I would say a little less than half of the United States, they don't want to live. We don't want to live in post-truth culture, but the rest of the country seems to enjoy it. So that is the wrinkle that we are at right now. By the way, if you're a foreigner and you're thinking of moving to America in the next, I don't know, between now and let's say November of this year, I would advise against that. I would wait for the fireball that potentially may occur here later in the year and decide, pick another country. That would be my best bet for you right now. So who is this podcast for? Well, it's for anyone that shoots, insert whatever brand you want. Just kidding. This is for anyone who has not taken a side in the Hall & Oates lawsuit. We all know, well, you better know, what Hall & Oates is, and you better know their contribution to society, and you better know that they are living and walking the earth gods, Daryl Hall and John Oates, the musical duo from the 1980s and 90s. Well, apparently they're having some squabbles. They're having some mad squabbles, boy. And there's a lawsuit now. I don't have no idea what it's about. I can't even pay attention to it because it's so damaging to me to know that these men are not in their cryogenic chambers at night prepping for the next show. But if you've managed to stay neutral because you know the importance of Hall & Oates, well, then I think you're where you should be. Welcome aboard. The hero of the week dates back to Seattle, Washington in 1973. I am a believer that the best music in the history of music came from the 1960s and 1970s, came out of the United States. Those two decades to me are musically hard to argue with in terms of influence of what came out of that time frame. I just think those are the power decades. Male dominated. Certainly some amazing female acts came out of that time frame as well, but always male dominated. However, a couple of days ago, listening to the radio, because that's what I do. I have like an AM radio taped to my ear because, you know, I'm super high tech. And I heard a song from a little band from Seattle, Washington, from 1973, and a little duo of Ann and Nancy Wilson, a little band called Heart. And if you haven't heard Heart, well, today's your lucky day. And I heard a song, and I was like, man, this is a badass song. And to think these two sisters came out and formed this band in 1973 in Seattle, I was like, I need to mention them. I need to mention Heart. And oh, by the way, when I was in middle school and I first saw Nancy Wilson, I was like, I don't know what that is, but I want one. I just want whatever that is. And so I've had the total hots for Nancy Wilson. But anyway, just wanted to mention my hero of the week is Heart. If you haven't listened to Heart, you should. They were way ahead of their time. Great vocals from Ann Wilson, and Nancy was on the guitar. And I'm sure there's some other schlubs in the band, but really those two are the ones that matter to me. Okay, our goat of the week, and that is not greatest of all time. That is goat, ass, donkey, mule, stooge. There are plenty of these people out there. Oh my God, it's just hard narrowing it down. So we've got Jared Kushner could be on this list every single week. And if you look up, let me just do this right now. I am going to look up sociopath. I'm going to look up the definition. What are the traits of sociopaths? Lack of empathy, impulsive behavior, attempting to control others with threats or aggression, using intelligence, charm, or charisma to manipulate others. Okay, I'm going to skip that one. Not learning from mistakes or punishment, lying for personal gain, showing a tendency towards physical violence and fights. No, I am not talking about Donnie Dipshit. I'm not talking about Trump. I'm talking about Kushner. And the first thing I want to focus on is the first item on the list, lack of empathy. Sociopathic people have it's a disorder that makes it impossible for them to feel empathy towards others. And I heard an interview with Jared Kushner, who has completely rewritten what happened during his time working for his father-in-law. He has just erased what happened and rewritten it with a fictional narrative because, again, I would say 65 or 70% of the American public seems to be totally fine living a completely fabricated narrative. But he was talking about how and why he got a $2 billion gift from the Saudi Foreign Investment Fund shortly after leaving office. And we all know basically why he got this, but of course you can't say that because it would sound terribly illegal. And so he kind of has rewritten it. But the smarminess that comes out of this guy, and the first time I ever saw him, there was something terrible happening. And there was a group of all, you know, the administration was gathered together. They were assessing what was happening. He was in the back of the room and he was smiling. And I said to my friend who passed away last year, I said, look at his face. I go, that is like classic sociopathic behavior where everyone in the room is like on rails because something terrible has happened. And he's smiling. So anyway, Kushner's on my list. The two guys who shot up the parade in St. Louis, any moron who brings a gun to a parade, you're on my goat list automatically. So we're going to talk about this in a minute, this whole gun control and bringing a gun to a parade thing. That just is mind-blowing. But I think the group that jumps out at me the most this week for being on my list is the Christian nationalists here in America. The Christian nationalist group. Now, if you're new to this group, you should be maybe boning up on your reading about what they're actually doing, because they have fully infiltrated the American political system. The current Speaker of the House has their flag flying outside of his office, among many other things. They are attempting to bring American culture, society, and government, which, by the way, they claim to be here to serve the religious movement, not the other way around, by the way. They want religion basically to take over every aspect of life, including government. They do not want a separation of church and state. They are aligned with people like this wacko Supreme Court justice in, I want to say, Alabama or Mississippi or wherever it was a couple of weeks ago that quoted the Bible in his legal decision. These people are all over the place. And ultimately what they're attempting to do is reverse our Enlightenment. Renaissance, scientific area, era, Enlightenment, they want to reverse that. They want to take it from Enlightenment to science to Renaissance to Dark Ages. They want America back in the Dark Ages. And man, if you have not been paying attention to where they are and who they are and where they're popping up, you should, because they are having a massive influence on American political structure as we speak. And I think they are crazy. They are absolutely crazy. And by the way, if you're not a Christian nationalist, then you are on their list. They do not want you around. It's pretty staggering. Again, America is what I said earlier. If you're someone from another land and you're thinking of trying to come to the United States and between now and the next election cycle, my advice is to wait, because you may want to find someplace a little smarter next time. I don't know. Plenty of countries out there. Again, our numbers suck. We exceed infant mortality, but education we're not so good at. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about points. The point system. Where do we start here? God, I've got some tech. I'm excited about a new piece of technology that's coming out. Yes, me, excited about technology. The irony does not escape me. We got a thing about COVID I want to talk about. We're going to talk about the border, talk about Europe, talk about Ultimate Fighting Championships coming up and something that just went down. I'm very curious as to what's going to happen this coming weekend. Artificial intelligence, Nat Geo Photography Series, guns. But the first thing I want to talk about is my upcoming workshop in Japan. So I just finished a blog post about the Japan workshop, but it's not the kind of blog post you're thinking of. It's about a daydream I had about the workshop. And by the way, if you don't daydream, you're missing out. Daydreams are awesome. Daydream is where your brain will find the trail between one creative moment and another, between ideas, between things that are just off the edges of your mental playing field that a daydream can bring onto the field for you. But before I start into this Japanese workshop, and I need to talk about why I wrote the blog post. And I wrote the blog post because I'm not on YouTube anymore. So I quit YouTube a couple of weeks ago, and I cannot believe how productive I have been since. I cannot believe. I have learned more about Adobe InDesign in the last 2 days than I did that I knew in the last 10 years, and that is not an exaggeration. I can do things in Adobe InDesign now that I only dreamt about. So the books that I'm making now, I'm working on a portfolio book from the Antarctic stuff that I need to use for the blurb film, and I need to use it for an experiment I'm going to do in the Netherlands later this year. And it looks way different than it would have if I was still on YouTube. And I've also done a ton of writing, and I've also been working on some artwork that I like. It's not good because I'm terrible at art, but it's fun, and it kind of makes me think differently about all my future projects. And the result of all this is because I am not on YouTube. And one of the things that you'll realize when you're a YouTuber is not only the time it takes to create the films, but the time you waste looking at other films that you really shouldn't be doing only because you're already there. You know, you're already on YouTube, and then it pops up in your feed and you're like, oh, I guess I'll watch this for 7 minutes. And then you're like, God, that's 7 minutes. I can't get back, kind of thing. So I got an email from Elena Dorfman, who is my co-instructor, my friend. We teach together in Albania, and we are going to teach in Japan in September. And I got her email newsletter. And the email newsletter just sent me into this amazing daydream about the Japan workshop. And when I think about the Japan workshop, it's very different. I don't think about this like a photography workshop per se, even though that's the primary pursuit. Is for me personally, it's the photo essay approach of like, I'm going to spend 10 days in Japan moving from place to place to place and make this perfect photo essay. It's not really how it works for me. Other people like to do that. For me, it's an opportunity to experiment. And this goes back to 1997 when I took my first workshop. I was a Kodak employee. I took a workshop at the Santa Fe Workshops. It was with one National Geographic photographer. He canceled at the last minute, and another National Geographic photographer stepped in. I had really set the table for myself at that workshop before I got there. So I had the story that I wanted to work on. I had the location sorted out. I had the permission to be at the location sorted out, which was not easy. I had done all of that. Had I not done that, I would not have been able to do that story. So when the workshop started, I said to this photographer, look, I'm not going to be here for any of the classwork. I'm going to be in the field the entire time. I will come back at the end of the day. I understand I'm going to miss things, but this is my goal. And he was like, go for it. Like, you know, this story is interesting. You've done your homework. You've done your research. It's a long drive to get there. You should go. And I did. And so at the end of the week, I only had about 6 images. Now, they were good images, and they were images that were literally impossible to make anywhere in the United States outside of the specific location I was. So they were, you know, they were important images to the overall story, but I only had about 6. And I think in the final slideshow of the class, they might have shown 2 or 3. And, you know, I was like, man, that's a lot of work for not a lot of success. You know, I thought to myself, man, I'm just going to kill it here. This is a workshop. I'm going to kill it. I'm going to walk out of here with a full essay, and it's going to be a book material and just crazy, delusional stuff. And as we were wrapping up the class, the photographer looks at me and he says, man, I am so jealous of you. And I'm thinking to myself, what just happened? Like, he's not talking to me. He must be talking to somebody behind me, or he's looking in the mirror. I don't know. He's like, no, I'm really jealous of you. And now I'm looking at, here's a guy who's done numerous assignments for National Geographic. And this was back when those assignments were real assignments, like long with fixers and research and midterm reports and full, you know, he was on contract. And it was like the end of the glory era of Nat Geo. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, you work on personal projects more than I do. And that sentence triggered our relationship. And we became friends. And he taught me so much about photography that wasn't about photography. And it totally changed my life. And that was 97. So when I look at workshops like Japan in September, I don't look at it like I'm going to make a bunch of pictures and put them on Instagram as fast as possible and see how many strangers and bots are going to pat me on the back. I look at it like, how is this going to change my life? And how is that going to allow me to potentially help the students change their life? So I don't look at it like a straight workshop. That, to me, it's not enough anymore. I think that there are so many different variables involved in a workshop, experiencing a new place, a new language, a new people, other students, taking chances, making mistakes, adding new elements to your work. How do you come out of the workshop looking at the world differently than you did when you went in? That is my advice to anyone taking a workshop. It is what I do even when I'm teaching a workshop. I try to think to myself, all right, how am I going to come out of here differently than I came in? And so Japan in September, I'll put a link to there's a link to it in the blog post that I just wrote. And so the blog post covers some of the same stuff that I'm talking about right now, and I'll put a link to it there. I can't wait. It's going to be a blast. Japan's been high on my list for a long, long time. Unlike Antarctica. Antarctica was never on my list. I never thought about going to Antarctica until someone said, do you want to go to Antarctica? And I was like, of course. And then it happened. But it was never on the list. Like, Japan has been on the list for a long time. India is on the list. But India is a place I don't even want to go to unless I have like 3 months. I don't want to go to India in like 10 days and like walk around in a felt hat shooting film. I don't want to do that. I want to go and immerse because it's just too much. It's just too much. If you spent 3 months in one city in India, it's not enough. So think about Raghu Rai. Think about how much time that guy put in the field and then reset your calendars. Okay, point number two. A few weeks ago, Kansas City Chiefs, those arrogant bastards, won the Super Bowl. They beat the New Orleans Saints. It was illegal. No, wait, stop. That's not right. The Saints should have won the Super Bowl, but they didn't because the world is unfair. And the bastards, the Kansas City Chiefs, won. And they had, like they always do after the Super Bowl, they always have a victory parade. And tons of people that should be at work, tons of people that called in sick, tons of people that claim their kids, like kidney fell out. They're all at the parade, like celebrating, right? That's what we do here. And two bozos got in a gunfight in the middle of a parade, killed a woman, injured numerous other people. And once again, one side of our political establishment says, well, nothing we can do about it. It's all mental illness. Got to solve mental illness. First of all, let me reset the table here. I grew up in a rural household. I grew up in a household that was filled with guns. I grew up in a household where both of my parents were shooting instructors. My parents taught concealed carry for Texas DPS. I was a competitive shooter. My father was a competitive shooter. I've been around guns my whole life. These morons at the parade, I don't want them to have guns. They clearly illustrated that they shouldn't have guns. And I do believe that we have to completely and utterly rewrite the gun control laws in America because they're not working. And if you bring a gun to a parade, you, my friend, are a moron. And there are a lot of morons in America. So a lot of the folks that I see talking about guns a lot are the exact kind of people that I wish didn't have guns. If you are a person sitting around waiting to be attacked and all tacticaled out and you're just armed to the teeth and you think that the world is out to get you and that people are coming to take your guns, you are flat out crazy. You know how I know? Because that was my father. My father for 40 years talked about the jack, quote, this is my father's quote, jackbooted thug Democrats coming to take his guns. And I would always joke, you mean the guy in the Prius with the Bernie sticker? You think that guy's coming to take your guns? No one's coming to take your guns. And yet every year, this was the bold proclamation because my father needed some sort of fictional enemy out there to make his life a little bit more salacious, a little bit more flavorful. There had to be something, some evil entity. And I'm like, have you taken a look at the Democrats recently? Not exactly a toothy group of people here. They're pretty much laying down. I think The Guardian wrote an article today about the Democrats sleepwalking into a Trump win. And man, I don't think I could have said it any better. The Democrats have done absolutely nothing over the last 4 years to improve their standing. And I think they're going to pay the ultimate price come November. But let's get back to the issue at hand here. The issue at hand here is this the gun situation. So I don't know how you explain away what happened in Kansas City, but we've got multiple mass shootings here in America pretty much every week. There's been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. We seem to don't even pay attention to them anymore. So anyway, I think we have to redo the gun situation. We have to change things. And what are the odds of that happening in the current mental state of our country? Zero. Because when you hear the pro-gun people talking, they are straight-up lunatics. Don't know how else to say it. And again, I'm going to remind you out there, because I know some of the people listening to this are straight-up gun lunatics. You're not talking to a guy who doesn't know about guns. You're not talking to somebody who didn't grow up with guns. You're not talking to somebody who doesn't know how to shoot guns. I know. I'm very well-versed. That was in my hand. Many years of my life, I was surrounded by that culture, and I thought the same thing back then, and I certainly think it now, that we have to, we have to get past post-truth. We have to get back to logic and intelligence and move on. And yes, like I said before, there is no chance in hell this happens right now. I just wanted to throw it out there. Okay, point number three, Sora. The Sora. Let me look this up again. This is fascinating. This is not a new model of Toyota, by the way, although it could be. Sounds like it. The Toyota Sora. It runs on pig vomit. Okay. Sora, OpenAI, is an AI model that could create realistic and imaginative scenes from text instructions. Okay, what's the story I'm looking for? Sora and what's the dude's name, the big producer? Tyler something. Tyler Perry. Okay, not now. Use your precise location. F you, Google. Okay, 8 days ago, after seeing OpenAI's Sora, Tyler Perry says jobs are going to be lost. No shit. So Tyler Perry apparently was building a massive production studio, $800 million studio expansion. He gets a single demo of Sora and puts the entire project on hold and then says, quote, jobs are going to be lost. This is a major understatement. Here's the thing about Sora and OpenAI and what's happening right now. I think no matter if you think you're on top of what's happening with AI, and I'm not putting myself in that space at all. You know me in tech. Whatever you think is happening, you're underselling. It's happening faster, and it's happening more already. And I don't know how entire industries are going to survive. That is photo, that is illustration, that is design, that is the art, that is marketing, sales. I don't know how these industries are going to survive. For a guy like that to put an $800 million project on hold, think of the amount of money outside of the $800 million to build. How many other hundreds of millions are tied to that lost revenue and lost project? And that's just one. So I think that the AI is it, not only, you know, people talk about machines becoming sentient. I don't know about that. That could be kind of cool. I mean, maybe they just line us up and milk us and then throw our carcasses in the jungle like Predator. We all gonna die. What's the matter, Billy? I'm afraid. No, you're not. You're not afraid. Well, I'm afraid. I'm afraid of Billy, let alone the AI Predator creature that's out there. But here's the thing about AI. As I mentioned before, I quit YouTube, and now I'm learning InDesign. And I can go to ChatGPT or OpenAI, and I can say, design me a spread with X, Y, and Z, and it will do it, and it's probably superior to what I can make, right? That's not a big stretch. But I don't want to do that. I want to learn how to make it. Now, that probably puts me in the minority, because I think a lot of people would just say, well, I'd like to get paid to do it, but I don't really want to learn how to do it. I would just rather ask AI to do it and then have that happen. And I think it's going to happen. But I've not been on a chat. I've not been on an AI site ever. I've not once gone to anything that's AI because I don't want to. I want to be the holdout. But it's coming, man. It is coming, and it is going to destroy entire industries. I'm actually really glad I'm 55 and not 25, because why would you learn a skill like coding? Why would you learn coding? Why would you learn any skill that OpenAI can do? Because it's going to be better than you. And that's kind of scary. Like, what are you going to be, a farmer? You could farm. You could dig ditches. You could be a tattoo artist. The designs might come from AI, but maybe somebody has to still sit there with the ink gun, and maybe there'll be something like a human tattoo versus an AI tattoo. I don't know. But all I know is times are changing, my friends, and I don't honestly know where this goes. I think it's happening so quickly. I think it's probably happening quicker than even the people who invented this stuff have realized. And frankly, the whole sentient thing, hang on, agua. The sentient thing is based on the Terminator films. It doesn't look that bad. There's always like smoking hot people in an underground bunker, and you know, they still have like booze and cigarettes. Remember in Waterworld with Kevin Costner, another just absolute masterpiece of cinema history. Remember, I think Dennis Hopper was the villain, and he's on the giant tanker ship floating around, and he's smoking cigarettes. And I'm like, okay, so where'd that come from? Who's the casting director here? Who's the person supposed to be paying attention to details here? Where'd that cigarette come from? They're going to run out. Okay, point number four. National Geographic, Jimmy Chin and his wife, whose name I cannot pronounce, I apologize. Very successful filmmaking duo, very successful photographer in Jimmy Chin, we all know, North Face. Lots of stills for years and years. Also an amazingly accomplished climber. His climbing is arguably more impressive than his photographic career, although the dude has got it going on, no doubt. And so does his wife. She's a very successful filmmaker, producer, director kind of person, and more power to him. I always seem to find interest in what it is they're working on. They have launched a new film series or documentary series about national, it's put on by Nat Geo, but it's about photographers. I have not seen it. My guess is I probably won't see it for the foreseeable future. I have not seen Barbie. I will probably never see Barbie. I have still not seen Oppenheimer, and I live in New Mexico. That tells you how far behind the curve I am. So I will probably not see the series, but there is one person. Hang on a sec. Hang on. Now that I got my fancy schmancy keyboard here set up. I'm going to go and let's see here. Nat Geo Photographer Series. Did you see how fast I type? Always been a fast typer. Okay, premieres March 18th on National Geographic at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. It is available to stream on March 19th on Disney and Hulu. Don't even know what that is. For over 135 years, National Geographic has built a storied legacy, and the visual storytelling showed an interconnected world through the work of thousands of renowned photographers. Thousands is a bit high. I don't think it's been that many, but I'll let you go with that one, Business Wire. Nat Geo, 135 years. Yeah, too bad it's coming crashing down. I think that magazine is days are numbered, but that's just me. All right, let's see here. Nat Geo, American Society of Media Photographers, ASMP. I used to be a member of ASMP. Let me go to their site. Okay, who we got here? Let's see here. I should have done this before I started, but, you know, you're kind of going along with me. This is how it works here. National Geographic has revealed the seven iconic photographers featured in the upcoming documentary series Photographer by Ichai Vasaharely and Jimmy Chin. Nailed that pronunciation. Let's see here. They will direct the series pilot episode centered on two of the world's most prolific and influential ocean photographers, Paul Nicklin and Christina Mittermeier. I'm wondering if Paul Nicklin is the son of Flip Nicklin, who used to be a Nat Geo photographer back in the day and did a lot of their underwater stuff. And Christina Mittermeier, I find really interesting. I think I met her at the Palm Springs Photo Festival years ago. I want to say she's a Sony-sponsored photographer, and I get her email newsletter, which is really well done. It doesn't feel like it comes on any specific schedule. I get them intermittently. It's not like some other people's newsletters I get where it's like, they're a very, very structured routine. I think hers is kind of all over the place, but that is most likely because she's probably under the water somewhere. Totally get that. I like her email newsletter. She seems like an interesting person. She's very driven. She's very organized. She's very successful. To get to that, I don't know Paul Nicklin. I'm sure he's an amazing underwater photographer. My guess is he's the son of Flip, but again, I could be wrong as well. But hey, this podcast is mostly about being wrong. So there you go. There is a person here. Now, it says that they determine which seven they're going to be, but this article does not list them, which does not help me at all. But there's one name in particular that I am looking for, and I just want to verify that I got this story right. Yeah, there's a trailer. I don't want to watch the trailer. Just tell me. Damn it. Business Wire. You mother. Here we go. Christina, where is it? I just saw it. God damn it. What? Maybe I'm wrong about this. No. There it is. Okay, I wasn't totally wrong. Okay, Paul Nicklin and Christina Mittermeier is the first episode, I'm guessing, here. It's one of them. And then Anand Varma, don't know him or her. Campbell Addy, don't know. Crystal Wright, don't know. Muhammad Muhassin, don't know. The one I do know is Dan Winters. And Dan Winters is arguably one of the most versatile, celebrated, and renowned photographers working today, widely known for his unusual and iconic portraits of celebrities, scientific work, street photography, illustrations, and capturing the hallowed grounds of NASA. He is a Nat Geo Explorer and has won over 100 national and international awards from World Press Photo, American Photography, SIPA, Communication Arts, Society of Publication Designers, Life Magazine, and the Alfred Eisenstadt Award for Magazine Photography, among others. While Dan has reached the pinnacle of photography with the help of his wife and manager, Catherine, he now feels at times he neglected his family. As we travel with Winters to Kennedy Space Center, Iceland, and Bangladesh, working to make iconic images and chase a childhood memory, he reflects that sometimes the most important moments are found not halfway around the world and behind a camera, but back at home. So I happen to know him, and my wife is good friends with his wife, and he's a very interesting cat, and his work is so diverse and so different from the vast majority of people I see out there working with cameras that'll be interesting. But here's the thing about Nat Geo, and this is why this is going to be, to me, is going to be, it's built for the masses who have a romantic notion of what photography is and how it works. If they were to actually make a film about how a photographer has to work, I think people would be so depressed that they would probably say, I don't even really want to watch this. Because I think about 80% of what all of these people are doing is business. It's all the shit that you have to do behind the scenes that's awful, that's getting harder and harder to do. It's the bidding, it's the billing, it's the going after clients who haven't paid, it's the limited time, it's the travel frustrations, it's all of this stuff that is just not fun. And then it's the 20% or the 15% or the 10% where you're out in the field making images. Yeah, that can be amazing, but you can't really make a film about that because I'm not sure anybody, and when I say anybody, I'm talking about the public. Photographers, they're going to watch it. The dorks, the geeks, the prosumer geeks that are on the gear sites all day long, yeah, they're going to watch it because they're just going to fixate on what cameras all these people are using. And if they have a red soft release button or something strange like that. But for the other people, they don't want to know. For the general public doesn't want to know. They want the fairy tale. They want the fairy tale. Like, it's like DiCaprio in Blood Diamond. When he's at the bar putting out the vibe, and the smoking hot female lead comes over, Jennifer Connelly, who just seems to get better and better and better looking as we go along. That's just an observation on my part. I'm not making any kind of profound statement here. I'm just saying. They're in the bar. DiCaprio's putting out the vibe. And she starts quizzing him about blood diamonds. And he's like, you know, you're a hypocrite because, you know, every American girl wants a big rock on a finger. And he's got that South African accent. You'll never leave Africa, Danny. T-I-A. This is Africa. Anyway, I digress. I will probably see the Nat Geo series at some point, but it will probably be a year after it comes out if I hold to tradition. Okay, number five. We are talking UFC. And for those of you out there who are like, I hate sports and the UFC is human cockfighting and sports are dumb and all that. Well, I've been getting that my whole creative life because I've said this many times before. A lot of times in the creative field, people look down on sports. They look down on athletics. They look down on hunting and fishing. They look down on anything that's not like sort of, kind of elite arty type behavior. But I'm not one of those people. I kind of like a little bit of everything. And so I don't like all of the UFC. I think Dana White has some absolutely crazy ideas, and I think he's a hypocrite in many, many, many ways, but at the same time, he's built an absolute empire, which you have to give him credit for, because nobody had done that before, at least that in the sport that he chose. So I don't like the heavyweight guys because they're overweight and they lack technique, and they basically just get in there and throw haymakers until they gas out because they haven't done their cardio. I'm not a big fan of that. What I do like are the small, skilled fighters that can strike, grapple, jiu-jitsu, wrestle. They can fight from the ground. They can fight from their feet. I find it interesting. They got great cardio. They can go five rounds. They are technicians that adapt on their feet to a changing environment. Do I strike to win this fight? Do I grapple? Do I do jiu-jitsu? Do I have to wrestle? How does jiu-jitsu stack up against wrestling? How does wrestling stack up against Sambo, the Russian? By the looks of it right now, Sambo trumps wrestling and jiu-jitsu. But every fight is a little different, and fights can turn on a dime. And so the past couple of weeks have seen some amazing fights. This Saturday, Sean O'Malley and Chito Vera are going at it for the second time. The only loss on O'Malley's record is to Chito Vera, which was in kind of a strange fight, at least initially it seemed strange how Chito won that fight. But since the time of that fight, the leg kick has become so much more prominent in the sport that you look back on that fight and you say, yeah, Chito won. He hit the nerve on the outside of the calf. It deadened O'Malley's leg. He couldn't stand on it. He took him down, hit him with an elbow. It was over. And so at the time, everyone said, oh, O'Malley's hurt. His leg broke. He's broke his ankle. He broke his foot. He didn't. It was because Chito hit the nerve on the outside of the calf, the outside of the knee and the calf area, which deadens the feeling to your leg, and it doesn't come back right away. So again, a strange, at the time, a bit of an odd strategy that worked out. Now these guys are going at it again. O'Malley is the bantamweight champion, which I cannot believe I'm saying that, but he is. And I just keep thinking he's going to lose. Like every when he fought Aljamain Sterling a couple of months ago for the title, I was like, there is no way. And I like Sean O'Malley, but I was like, there's no way he can win. Because Sterling is just going to go out, take him down, and submit him. And then O'Malley knocked him out. And I was like, I'm wrong once again. And so I think Chito Vera is going to win this fight, and then O'Malley will probably go out and prove me wrong again. But if you haven't watched it, it's a very interesting mix-up of styles. There's a ton of other fights on this card this weekend. And by the way, I don't watch these fights. I haven't watched an MMA fight. I check in after the fact. And then if I can, if I have time, I might watch a 60-second highlight reel of what happened. But I don't do pay-per-view. I don't even have a TV that I can do pay-per-view on. And my TV is unplugged in our bedroom, and I have an iPad. So that kind of tells you how technologically challenged I am, but I'm getting to this in a minute because there is something new on the horizon for me, my friends. And yeah, you're not going to look at me quite the same. You're going to be like, holy shit, this guy has really taken off, and he's kind of a tech savant. It could happen. Okay, I was in the airport flying back from Jamaica, and on the trip to Jamaica, two segments, we go from northern New Mexico. We go from Albuquerque to Dallas, Dallas to Montego Bay, and then reverse that a week later. On the flight from, where was it? On the flight, oh yeah, the flight from Dallas to Montego Bay, my wife gets upgraded, which is like a great thing. She's in first class. I'm back in coach, but I'm in exit row, and I have six seats to myself. So, all right, hang on. Brother is calling. Got to take this. Hang on one second. Okay. That was a 30-minute intermission there with a call with my brother. And there could be another motorcycle joining the Milner family. Yeah, so that's going on. He was like, next time you come here, bring your helmet because there may be two bikes in the garage. Could be interesting. We are a dual sport family kind of thing. So this could be a KTM. It could be a BMW. It could be a Royal Enfield. It could be a Honda 300L Rally. We don't know. I know. You don't. And I'm not going to tell you what it is because it should be a surprise, goddammit, when it actually happens, if it does happen. Okay. So we're done with that. I was telling a story about coming through the airport and my wife got upgraded. Well, that sounds like a great thing on the surface, but what happened was as soon as she gets upgraded, they split our reservation. It now goes under two different reservation locator numbers, which means that everything that you have associated with that original number gets erased, which is so typical American flying nonsense bureaucracy. It's so maddening. So by the time we go to leave Jamaica, there's two record locator numbers now instead of one. So my wife has like, you know, 2 million mile flyer with American. She's about to be platinum for life. She typically is the one that handles the reservations because it's all under her platinum for life kind of stuff. And so now all of a sudden I don't exist. So everything gets erased, including my TSA number. So I get my boarding pass and of course there's no TSA pre. And I'm like, you mother. And I go to the security guy in Dallas Airport on the way back. And I'm like, dude, you guys keep erasing my TSA pre number. And he goes, oh, all you have to do is leave the airport. Yes, that's what this bozo said as I'm standing there in security line. Leave the airport, come back in, go to a ticket agent and have them reprint your boarding pass. And I was like, and the people in line next to me looked at him and said, are you kidding? Did you just really suggest that as a viable option for a traveler trying to catch a connecting flight? So as I'm standing there in the security line, now I am with the great unwashed. I am not in the TSA pre-line. I am in the great unwashed, untouchable, undesirable, unwashed masses who have to take off their disgusting shoes and their laptops out of their backpacks. Oh, how ghastly. And the guy in line in front of me is looks like he's a middle American. It looks like he's from dead center, right down the middle of the plate, America. And his response to me getting stuck in the non-TSA pre line is, "Geez, man, we have such a porous border that you would think our airport security would be better." Now I'm thinking, okay. Bozo the clown here has equated my TSA pre-woes to a, quote, porous border. Now, this is clearly a guy who's watching right-wing television. And I said to him, ever been to the border? And he looked at me as if I had landed from planet Orb. He was like, no. And I said, well, how do you know how porous it is? And then, before he could answer, I said, you're talking about the Canadian border, right? And that threw him. I don't think he had ever once in his life thought that there was another border. I said, you're talking about the Canadian border, right? I go, that place is crazy. There's 1,000 miles unmanned. I go, people are coming across that thing all the time. I said, it is like an unbridled invasion of pasty white poutine-eating Canadians, and no one is stopping them. And I just kept going. I laid it on thick, like gravy on this guy. And I got to the point where he couldn't respond. He just turned around and went back to his family. And I said, I won. Even though I'm stuck in this line with you great unwashed masses, I have won this conversation for the day. The takeaway from that little encounter was he was just parroting what he'd heard on right-wing TV. But when I spun it to the Canadian border and I looked at his face and I realized, oh, he's never once thought that that's a border too. He's only obsessing over the southern border. He forgot about the north. And then I said, it's, you know, there's thousands of miles of unmanned territory and pasty poutine eating Canadians. I don't think he knew what poutine was. I'm not sure he understood the pasty Canadian reference. And I said, they're coming over by the thousands. He had a look of panic on his face that just made me so warm inside. I can't explain it. Okay, let's move on. I'm headed to Europe. If any of you out there are Euro trash, heads up, Uncle Dano's on the way. So London, first public appearance, May 12th, Sunday, photo walk, meetup, London. Be there or I'm never talking to you again, Brexit people. I expect all of you to be there. Not that your public transportation is working anymore. Just kidding. May 12th, photo walk London. May 16th, photo London, the actual event, photo London. The 17th, I fly to Menorca, Spain for my workshop with Ross Society and Sarah Lean. We are on the island of Menorca for a week. Then I fly to Barcelona. The 27th of May, I will be doing a photo walk and meetup in Barcelona, Spain. So for all you Spanish-speaking wizards out there, I expect you to be there in force, in mass, wearing red sashes and whatever else you do in Spain that confuses me for whatever reason. And then afterwards, I will be going, if all holds true to plan as of right now, and that's, I would say, a 50-50 proposition, I will be in Eindhoven, in the Netherlands for 3 days. And Europe is kind of on the table for my wife and I. I after we came back from Paris in November, and my wife said, you know, we should come over here for a while and sort of live and hang out. And Blurb, it's a good thing for Blurb if I'm in Europe, so they're not opposed to it by any means. And I am looking at the Netherlands. I'm looking at Eindhoven, and I'm looking at Rotterdam, and I'm looking at Amsterdam, and I'm looking at sort of looking around at what's possible over there. I don't think I would base out of the UK. I don't think France. I think I would base out of the Netherlands, but I'm not entirely sure. But Europe is on the table. So if you're going to be anywhere in those areas at that time, let me know. Reach out, and I will steer you to where I'm going to be. There's going to be some Blurb stuff, there's going to be some Milner stuff, and there's going to be some stuff in the middle. And I will be dashing. I will be standing in the street with a scarf and some sort of obnoxious camera around my neck, posing and maybe smoking unfiltered cigarettes and, you know, just during the Euro photo trash thing, if I can, if possible. Okay, moving on. Number 8, COVID. Remember COVID? Our best friend COVID? This is what I have learned now, after having quote unquote come out of COVID, which is a fallacy because COVID is still all over the place. It's not a week goes by that I don't have a friend or family member that has COVID somewhere. And I think that's just the way it's going to be until the next real virus hits and basically wipes out half the planet, which probably ultimately would not be a bad thing in the long run. But here's what I have learned about what we have learned about COVID? Nothing. Zero. We have not learned anything. We haven't. There is a defiance about disease now in America that is amazing. A couple of days ago, I saw someone who was visibly sick, and the person said, "I am really sick," and then proceeded to shake hands and hug everyone in the circle. This was here in New Mexico. And I was like, we haven't learned a thing. Like, no one knows what this person has, and the person is admitting publicly to everyone in the circle how sick they are. And now I'm backpedaling. As soon as the person says, "Oh man, I am really sick," my first thought is, you jackass, why are you at this event? If you're sick, why did you come into a public space in an enclosed area, visibly sick, admitting you're sick? Why would you do that? And then secondarily, the people who this person looked at and said, "I'm sick," they then proceeded to shake hands and hug the sick person. That is like, that is PCB, pre-COVID behavior, okay? We simply cannot do that anymore. And yet, because we survived COVID, there is a defiance that is hard to explain because of the level of ignorance. Because here's the thing, from everything that I can read about infectious disease, what's coming is going to make COVID look like you stubbed your toe. It is going to be horrible, what comes next. And unless we are prepared, and here's my fear. My fear is the next COVID, there will be no mask mandate. There will be no lockdown. Everyone will be, "Oh, we've been here and done this before," and "F you." And I mean, remember back to 2020, really more 2021. So COVID had sort of, you know, it was now an official thing. The people who were trying to deny that it was real or that it would magically disappear, those morons were outed. And by 2021, everyone's like, okay, we're in for the long haul. And I think that long haul wore us down, and America was literally crushed. The United States of America, the quote-unquote most powerful country in the world, half of our population was undone by a 4-inch piece of cloth. That's how fragile we are. That people said, "Oh my God, this is an invasion of my civil rights, and I can't believe it, and COVID is fake, and inject bleach, and all this other nonsense." A 4-inch piece of fabric. That, oh, by the way, in 1918, we figured out was pretty effective. So we'd known it for over 100 years, and yet suddenly it was an invasion of our rights, and we brought our entire country to its knees because of a 4-inch piece of fabric. So moving forward to the next COVID-20 or COVID-21, if you like odd numbers, let's just stick with COVID-21. I don't know, 21 just seems cool. It seems cooler than 20. We are screwed. And also, I don't think we have any national stockpiles anymore. I think we burned through like all the funding and all the supplies and everything else. I think we're hosed. You might want to dig in. Buy some non-perishables while you're at it. Okay, number 9. I heard an interview, two journalists interviewing each other the other day, and someone posed a question. And the question itself was baffling to me, but also very telling because it speaks to the actual reality of one of the super systems in America, which is our legal system. And not only the fragility of the legal system, but the fact that it doesn't work like it's supposed to work, unless you're, well, it doesn't work really like it's supposed to work. And it was two journalists, and they said, okay, and they were walking through, and let me see here, let me go to this, because this is good. This is really good. Okay, Trump legal cases all in one. So I got confused about all the indictments of Donald Trump. I got like the cases all crossed up. And so I was like, I'm confused because he has so many criminal cases against him and so many indictments against him that I just got confused because there's four major cases, but then inside of each case, there are all these different charges and indictments and all these different people involved. And I was like, I'm totally confused. So I found a website that's Donald Trump's criminal cases all in one place. Hush money case number one, classified documents two, election interference three, Fulton County, Georgia four. Then there's a summary of each one, the key evidence, the charges, the defendants, and how many counts against them. So for example, the hush money case, the summary is Trump was first indicted in March of 2023 in the Manhattan District Attorney on state charges related to a hush money payment to the adult film star in 2016. They allege Trump was part of an illegal conspiracy to undermine the integrity of the election. Further, they allege he was part of an unlawful plan to suppress negative information, including a $130,000 payment to one and only Stormy Daniels, which is an amazing name, by the way. Charge, falsifying business records in the first degree, defendant Donald Trump, counts 34. And then it goes down and it breaks down all the other cases. And, you know, I'm looking at classified documents here. There are 32 counts, willful retention of national defense information, false statements, conspiracy to obstruct justice, withholding a document, corrupt concealing a document in a federal investigation, election interference, conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct official proceeding, obstruction of attempt to obstruct official proceeding, conspiracy against rights. It goes on and on and on. And that's my point. So one journalist looks at the other one and says and asks, is it possible that he gets indicted? So think about that. If it was you or I that had four major criminal cases against us, hush money, classified documents, election interference, and whatever the Fulton County thing is, which is, what is it? Solicitation of violation of oath, false statements, filing false statements, solicitation of all this. If you or I had any one of these criminal cases against us, hush money, classified documents, election interference, or the Fulton County thing, if we had one of these counts against us, we're screwed. First of all, we're going to spend our entire life savings trying to defend ourselves. And two, the question the journalist asked was, is it possible? And in my head, I was like, think about the absurdity of that question. It doesn't matter if it's Trump or anyone or Daffy Duck that has four massive criminal cases against them, to have to ask the question if it's even possible that this person is penalized and goes to jail for one of, if not multiple, of these charges. Just having to ask the question if it's even possible tells you the state of the American legal system. It is so completely bent backwards and inside out and can't get over itself. If a guy like this, and granted, it's the president, so a former president, so it presents a very difficult scenario, because we've never been in this scenario before, and no one quite seems to have an answer to what happens when he is indicted, which I don't think he ever will be. I don't think Trump's, not only do I not think he's going to get indicted, I do not think he will ever see the inside of a jail cell. I've said that from the beginning. I don't know how you would even put a former president in jail, because it would mean that you would also have to put Secret Service details in jail, and that is probably unconstitutional. Now, if Trump does what he says and throws out the Constitution, then sure, you could put Secret Service people in jail for no reason if you wanted to. But I don't see there being a good way to put a former president in jail. I don't even know how legally any of this stuff would happen. I never once thought that Trump would ever see the inside of a jail cell. I do not think that he will ever get indicted on these cases. We saw 2 days ago that the Supreme Court unanimously ruled in his favor to keep him on the ballot. And for those of you lefty libtards out there, what did you think was going to happen when the case went to the Supreme Court? There is a reason why Donald Trump stacked the Supreme Court and the appellate court system in his favor. There is a reason for that. Trump is a shrewd dude. He has been committing white-collar crime his entire life, and he knew that if he won the presidency, the level of graft that would transpire under his watch would be unprecedented, and at some point, someone was gonna come calling, and the only way to protect himself was to load up the court system, and he did whatever he needed to do and say to load up that court with three wackadoodles that shifted the balance. So when the court went to the Supreme when the case went to the Supreme Court to judge, you knew they were going to say, look, leave him on the ballot. And I think any time the court, his criminal cases are deferred to the Supreme Court, they are going to always rule in his favor. Again, Trump, super shrewd. He loaded up the appellate court system. So a couple of those cases, he has appellate court judges, lower level judges, who are ruling in his favor all the time. And it's forcing them to go to higher courts that are having to overturn some of those decisions. These are clearly judges who are basically were put in place to do exactly what they're doing right now. So again, if you can love Trump or you can hate him, and even if you hate him, you have to admit that the dude is shrewd. He knew what he was doing when he was loading up the court system. And a lot of this was done kind of out of the public eye. It's not a sexy story. It's not, you know, Trump saying inject bleach. And the thing about Trump was every single day he either said something or did something that was so catastrophically stupid that the media loved it because it always led to ratings because he just can't get out of his own way. And so behind the scenes, if you're loading up the appellate court system, it's not sexy. Not a whole lot of people are paying attention to that. So, but to even ask to ask the question if it's even possible for someone with four major criminal trials against him, is it possible for this person to go to jail or be indicted? I think that's a testament to the statement to our system itself. Okay, 10th point. I'm going to roll through these pretty quickly. You know me; I love photography books. I've always loved photography books since about 1990 when I discovered the photography book section in the Austin Half Price bookstore, and I started buying books and looking at books. I love them. The number one photo book publishing deal that I see is photographer paying publisher to get a book. And this throws a lot of people, especially people who are unfamiliar with the photo book world. Because what happens is, when I say this to people who are unfamiliar with the world, and I'll say, look, these are like quote-unquote artist-supported books, meaning they're working with a traditional publisher, but the photographer is putting anywhere typically between $20,000 and $30,000 up front to get the book done. And I've seen $50,000 books, I've seen $100,000 books, but if I had to generalize, I would say $20,000 to $30,000 up front. 99% of the time, the artist does not see that money back. And they often get involved in a publishing cycle that is at least 12 months long. Typically, it's longer. It's 12 to 18 months. In many cases, they do not get the book they want. They're not exactly happy. They don't get marketing. They don't get distribution. They often don't get the design they want. And I hear about it because everybody knows I'm the blurb guy. And even though Blurb's not publishing these, they know that I know a lot of publishers and that I love photo books. And I'm sort of in that circle in some weird way. And they're like, man, you know, I'm not happy, or I can't get the books back, and they're going to destroy them for tax purposes. And I paid $15,000 and I only got 15 copies. Or I was on the print run and they said, if you don't give us another $5,000, we're not going to finish the print run. And so I got stuck. I'm on the hook for another $5,000. And, you know, I just hear all these crazy stories. That is the most common publishing deal I see. And when you explain this to non-photo people, they look at you like you are out of your mind. They are like, that is the worst business deal I have ever heard. And I'm like, I get it. I was approached twice to do this. I said no both times. And actually, I was approached three times. The first two were like classic photo book publishers. And I said, no, this is terrible. One, I don't have the money. And two, if I did, I wouldn't give it to you. And the third person came and wanted me to make a book I didn't want to make. And when I said no and got back to my life, years later, I was in a business meeting, and that person who I said no to was working for a different company and was also in this meeting, and I didn't remember her. And as she introduced herself around the table, and it came to my time to introduce myself, and before I could say anything, she looked across the table and she said, "You're the only one who said no." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she goes, "You don't remember me." And I said, "I apologize, but I don't." And she said, "I worked for such and such a publisher, and we approached you to do this book." And she said, "In the entire time I worked there, you were the only person to say no." And that always resonated with me. When I see photographers doing this, when I see skilled, talented people who have not gotten it together to understand that the old models of this industry and this business do not work for the most part. And again, there are some super smart publishing deals that happen. I have friends sitting within 5 miles of where I'm sitting right now who have done some amazing publishing deals. I know guys within 5 miles who have gotten advances on their photo books, believe it or not. I know people who have sold through all their runs. I know someone whose every book is a collector's item. It happens, but it's very, very rare, and it's happening less and less. And when I see photographers doing this, putting out tens of thousands of dollars to get a book that they may or may not be happy with, a book that comes with no marketing and no distribution, which means then for not only is the publishing cycle 12 to 18 months where they're kind of limited by what they're doing in the field because of how much work it is to do the book, then they have to spend all this additional time after the fact trying to market and sell on their own. And that window is very narrow. So it just pains me. And I just want you guys to know that there are other ways of doing this, but you have got to unwrap your head from the traditional ideology of putting a photo book into the world. That's all I want to say. Okay, point number 11 is I have an ongoing project here in New Mexico. I haven't spoken a lot about it because I've done so little on it that it's really not worth mentioning. But there's one aspect of it that I thought about the other day that I thought might be kind of interesting for people to hear. It's a project that will take me to all 33 counties in New Mexico, which is a way for me to explore my home state. And I've been all over the state, but there's still a lot of places I haven't been. And I was like, you know, I do a lot of travel, but it's also really fun to have a project that's closer to home and also a project that really gets me into the field to see some places in my state that I haven't seen yet. Pretty simple. It's a project that combines bird with traditional documentary and traditional stories. So we're talking culture and people and landscape and everything else about being in New Mexico, the kind of classic wide lens, black and white reportage stuff that I did in the past with color birding. So that's the general gist of the project. But if I didn't work, so like if I didn't have a job with Blurb and I was doing this full time, when I put pen to paper and tried to figure out how long it would take, best case scenario with no job working on this full time, it would take 3 years to do this project. Throw in the Blurb job and throw in the travel and throw in everything else. And I kind of realized like there's two schools of thought here. Is one, I'm a realist. I think to myself, okay, now best case scenario, we're talking 5 years, right? I'll be 60 years old by the time I'm finished with this thing. And the second school of thought is why even bother? Because if I think it's going to take five, it's going to take longer. And that's like, again, best case scenario. Like I've got a, you know, time to research and find events and plan things and be in town and be around the state when these things are happening. It's not likely. And so it's on one hand, it's very easy for me to just say, look, this is ridiculous. Why am I doing this? Because I'm never going to finish this project. But at the same time, it's such an alluring project because if I do it correctly, it will incorporate every single thing that I've ever learned. It will be the short lens, people-based reportage. It will be the birding photography. It will be writing, and it will be designing all this into a very atypical looking book. And that is so alluring, I can't stop thinking about it. And so that's why I'm going to forge ahead. And this Saturday, when I drop my wife off at the airport, I'm going to try to get out and do a shoot, even though I need to do some work on the website this weekend and get my email newsletter thing up and running because the timing is right to do that and blah, 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 blah. So last point. I'm going to skip 12 and 13. 12 was about insider trading in Congress, which is amazing. If you research that story, it's amazing how many members of our Congress are trading on insider information and nothing is happening to them. It's kind of crazy. And two, point 13 was about fragility of technology and things like Medium and Clubhouse and Substack and NFTs and how transitional things are in the tech world and how we tell each other that they're not because we all want to get on the same boat. And then that boat sinks and we all jump to the next raft and that raft goes under. And that seems to be like the perpetual cycle that's happening. But we can talk more about that later. The last thing I want to mention is we'll say point 14, is sometime this month, Apple is announcing the M3 iPad Pro, the new lineup of iPad Pros. And I have to tell you, I have had an iPad Pro for 8 years, and it still works. And I use it every single day that I'm home. I don't typically travel with it because I have a case on it, and this was 8 years old, so the case weighs about 35 pounds by itself. But I absolutely love the iPad. The iPad is the perfect combination of consumption and production. And I'm talking about my 8-year-old iPad, not even what's coming with the M3s. This thing, years ago, I went to, Adobe Max, the event that's held in Los Angeles, a very cool event. If you ever get a chance to go to Adobe Max, go. I walked in the building as a vendor for Blurb, and some security guy goes, "Hey man, get in line to get your computer." And I said, "No, man, I'm not supposed to be in the line. I'm a vendor." And he goes, "It doesn't matter. Everybody's getting in line. Get in line, get your computer." And I was like, "No, I'm pretty sure I'm not supposed to get a computer." And he's like, "Well, you're an idiot if you don't get in line to get a computer." And I was like, "Okay, I'll get in line to get a computer." So I wait in line. I'm like the last person in line. And there's like 5,000 people at this event. And I walk up and the person just hands me this box. And it's a Microsoft Surface Pro tablet. Microsoft Surface Pro something tablet. And I'm like, "I don't like Microsoft operating system. I'm going to hate this thing." So I take it home and I open it up, and it's basically like an iPad with a keyboard and ports. It had like a USB port. It had a USB-C port, all these things on it. I'm like, and it's touchscreen, of course, because it's a tablet, but it also comes with a keyboard. And I used this thing for like 5 minutes, and I was like, "Holy shit, this is the best interface I've ever seen. Like, this is what I want." Now, I used the Microsoft operating system drove me insane, and I ended up giving that computer away like 5 days later. But it stuck with me because I was like, why the hell can I not get a laptop from Apple that has a touchscreen? So in walks a sultry iPad M3, iPad Pro, 13-inch, whatever the big one is. I cannot wait to get this thing. Because the iPad to me is the only piece of computer technology I've ever had that makes me want to learn something new and makes me excited to interface through the technology. I don't feel that way about my laptop, even though the Blurb laptop they gave me is fine. It's an M1 laptop, MacBook Pro, and it's great. But also, everything I'm doing in my studio, every single thing I'm doing is all driven through the one MacBook Pro laptop. And most of the time, all the ports are taken up. When I'm doing certain things like transferring huge amounts of data, it's kind of impossible to use the laptop. It just freezes and like slows up so much that I'm like, I need to go take a nap or go for a ruck or do something. And to have a secondary computer is going to be great. I love some of the software applications that are available, like the Affinity Suite for the iPad is amazing. LumaFusion, I'm looking forward to learning, which is a video production software that's available for the iPad. You have Lightrooms available for the iPad. You have all the Adobe Suite kind of things. I love the Pen. I love Procreate. I love a lot of the app-based things. And now, because of a couple of different additional software additions that Apple has brought to the table, things like Stage Manager, you can use it more of like a computer. And here's the thing. I think for a lot of years, a lot of people wanted to replace their laptops and go much lighter and slower and go to the iPad. And people would do it for 6 months or a year, and then they'd be like, "I'm going back to my laptop." It never quite felt doable. It still felt like by the time you packed up all the dongles and cases and keyboards and everything else, it was no smaller than your laptop. But the thing is, I think with the advent of the new one, because I'm pretty close to being able to do everything I need to do on the one that I have now. And again, it's 8 years. The fact that I've had it in my hands for 8 years and it still works is a miracle. A miracle. It still works. And my wife, I was like, "I'm going to trade this thing in. It'll probably be worth like 65 cents. And my wife's like, "No way, man, I'm taking that one." So she wants this thing. The Pen's broken on both ends. I still use it. I love the Pen. I love the touchscreen. The M3 is going to be way faster than for anything I need to do on it. And it's really the first piece of tech that I've been excited about in a long time. And I just wanted to share it with you for no apparent reason. So if you're still here an hour and 15 minutes in, you are a warrior. Thanks for being here. I'm one guy with one opinion. And oh, by the way, inevitably somebody is going to write me. It's one of these delicate types that just happened a couple of weeks ago. I did a post about a book that happened to be about the Trump administration and the craziness and shenanigans that went on behind the scenes. And I said, most of these people, they just immediately assume that I'm in love with the Democratic Party, and that ain't the case. I'm an anomaly, and that's not something that a lot of people, especially people on the right, they can't handle that. They can't handle the fact that I have not drawn a line in the sand. They can't handle the fact that I have not sworn allegiance to a party. I'm a problem for them. So inevitably they write, someone wrote me and said, oh, I like your photography stuff, but you're an extremist. And they say this because the MAGA crowd cannot handle anyone saying anything realistic or negative about Donnie. So inevitably somebody's going to say that. And if you're one of these people out there that's like, oh, you're an extremist, here's my advice. Don't come to my site. That's the simplest thing to do. If what I'm saying is triggering you, you should find another website. I said the same thing to YouTubers who were infuriated by box speed conversations. I'm like, I'm not the guy for you. Go somewhere else. Like, why would you be here? The other thing that happens is the person that shows up every 3 or 4 months and then softballs out some backhand slaps, you know, jabs at me. And I write to them and say, why are you here? If this is triggering your sensitive sensibilities, why would you stay here? And they'll say, that's it, I'm never coming back. And I'm like, great, more power to you. Enjoy your life. Hope you're successful. Move on. And 3 months later, they're back doing the same thing again. They just can't stay away. My advice, stay away, because you are certainly not going to dictate what I talk about on the podcast or what I post on the site, because I don't care, man. Like I said, I got no plan, no schedule. It's whatever pops into my head at any random moment. So right now I'm going to get back to designing a book, a portfolio book from Antarctica that I need to use for two different film production things and an experiment in Eindhoven later in the year. And I need to design it, and right now it looks like a train wreck. Every spread looks like it's from a different book because I'm learning InDesign a lot more than I was before. Adios.